Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 18, delivered on March 29, 2012. The title of this lecture is Bonds.
Today, bonds. James Bonds. No, I shouldn't, whatever. You know what I mean. Now, I took you through pricing on bonds, and I would like to give you one more shot at doing the pricing of them, just another exercise, and I'll put up a quiz next week, not until next week, where you'll get a chance to show your mojo that you can price bonds, you can find their yields. Now, as I promised in the last lecture, I am going to spend at least part of today's lecture showing you real-world bond prices, yields, the quotes, and all that kind of stuff. Before I do that, I want to give you a little bit of terminology, enough so that you would be dangerous in your knowledge of bonds. Certainly, you should research, and if you want to know more about this subject, you'll obviously want to take more advanced classes, and you would obviously want to take them from me or not. But let me give you some terminology, some concepts in bonds. First of all, I had already distinguished among the bills, notes, and bonds. And I'll focus on bonds here. And bonds is kind of like a generic term for all of the different debt securities. Know this, that bonds have prior claim on the cash flows of a corporation. That was early on in the course. The debt holders have to be paid before the shareholders can make their claim, whether they are preferred or common shareholders. The bondholders get theirs. And in the event of a default, in other words, the company cannot pay all of its debts, that would drive it down to the point where the bondholders would take over the corporation unless the corporation seeks protection under bankruptcy law. If the company seeks protection under bankruptcy law, the court holds off the prior claim of the bondholders and allows the company to work through a negotiation process with those bondholders in what is generally called a reorganization under the auspices of a court-appointed receiver or trustee or something of that nature. Now, sometimes that works out and the bondholders are able to work something out with the company so that the company will survive and come out of Chapter 13 or chapter or whatever it is. Sometimes it doesn't work out and the bondholders say, screw it, we're just taking over the corporation, we're liquidating the assets, wiping it out, sending it to hell. An example of that would have been Circuit City. You might have seen recently struggles with some companies that are trying to keep themselves from having to file Chapter 11 status protection from the creditors. A good example, and I named these, interestingly enough, I named a group of companies that were in trouble in a previous finance class, the one last semester, and some of them, sure enough, have shown that they are in trouble since then. Among them would be Sears. Sears is struggling mightily to avoid dying. One that has just announced this closing of 50 stores. Who is it that today announced? Yeah, Best Buy is their business model. They thought they knew so much about how they were going to be able to just have everyone go to their online store and buy movies. The problem was that essentially for quite some time, Best Buy has had only one profitable area of business. That's been a cell phone business. And the rest of what made Best Buy the great big box company that it was had been flagging seriously. They're not in bankruptcy. Companies that are in bankruptcy or protection under the court. I can name you a number of those right now, but there are some that just didn't survive. They're gone from the landscape. They've just disappeared. A couple of things right off the bat, and I have experience with this particular area a little bit, but I'll give you a broader perspective. Corporate America has credit rating agencies, three major ones, that give their own ratings to bonds based upon the quality of the bond. And by quality, I mean the assurance that the bond will perform in a timely manner with respect to its coupons and with respect to the payment of face value at the maturity. Those rating agencies each one of them has its own system. And I'm certainly not going to ask you, the textbook goes through them, I'm certainly not going to ask you to tell me, well, here's a rating. Which agency would have done that rating with those letters, and what do these letters mean? I'm not going to do that in this class. But I will apprise you that the three big agencies are Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's. Fitch, you know, like Abercrombie & Fitch, except that they don't have clothes that are controversial. Moody's and Standard & Poor's. Those are the three big credit rating agencies. Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's, those are the three big credit rating agencies for corporate. You want me to try it again? The names? Okay, Fitch. Okay, Fitch. No, then Standard & Poor's. You don't know Standard & Poor's?
No.
Dude, I mean, they're very important. And then there is Moody's. And I'm not talking about, just what do you mean by that? Moody's is actually the name of a financial institution kind of thing. Now, here's the deal with these three credit rating agencies. And I learned something about these back in the day when I was a consultant. I brought companies public, and sometimes a company was already public, but it was a very small company and it was growing. And some of the things that I did for them, among getting them listed on a legitimate stock exchange, I would also get them into the hustle and flow of credit rating agencies, because this way investors can look at these credit ratings and they have more confidence in the company, because they've got these outside agencies essentially guiding investors. So that was something that I did, and I learned how to do this on my own, because back in that time, you didn't learn things like this in business college, even at the grad level. And that's something that when you hear me talk about things like this, the reason is that I didn't see. I walked in like Andy Hardy getting his ass kicked. And the first one I went to was one of these credit rating agencies. I won't name it. The company was doing pretty well, and it wanted to issue bonds, and I wanted to get the details. How do I get credit rating status with you guys? You know, I didn't know anything about. How do they just go around and look at bonds and figure out whether they're quality or not? No, you go through a process, an application process. And part of it was very similar to what I had done with getting this company listed on a stock exchange. But where it went different, and I got a real bad taste in my mouth for this whole process, was the fees and the fee structures. It seemed like the more legitimacy you wanted, the more you wanted them to pay attention to you, the more you had to pay. And if you really wanted to be taken seriously, you paid fees that no small company could possibly have paid. So it was sort of like the Mount Olympus was out of reach to this little company. They didn't have the money. I wasn't even going to go to them and say, we should get you listed with this bond credit rating agency, because the fees were just too stupid for them to bear. And that hurt us with respect to issuing bonds, and also with respect to issuing other kinds of securities as well in secondary offerings. So I have a little bit of a doubt in my mind from that. Now let's reel forward in time into the mid first decade of the 21st century, the middle of it. The stock markets in the 1990s had just been going crazy. Real, real strong, robust activity. By the time we get to about 2005, 2006, the cracks were appearing to any legitimate economist who wanted to just look at the numbers objectively and who wasn't on the payroll of something or other that tainted his or her analysis. I was writing as early as 2005. I see problems occurring in corporate stock markets, bond markets. I see this disjunction among the parts that put an economy together: consumption, private investment, public investment, and net exports. Something is going wrong. By the time we get to about the end of 2007 into 2008, the crisis, it was so obvious. There is a serious problem. Specifically, there are four parts to an economy in simple economics terms. There's consumption, private investment, public investment, government spending, and your net export picture. There, one of those four was buckling. It was right there in the 2007 data. Private investment was beginning to collapse. The other three were holding on, but it was like one part had finally given up and it had dropped away. But if you looked at the corporate rating agencies, the Standard & Poor's, the Moody's, the Fitch, and all of these analysts out there on TV and radio and in the newspapers, it's just everything's okay. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Everything is just, the sky's the limit. These derivatives markets are the greatest thing since sex and all of that kind of stuff. Let me tell you, sex is better than derivatives. It was like this disjunction. There were a few of us out there, we were called conspiracy theorists, naysayers, doomsayers. Well, you're just trying to sell your product. I didn't have a product to sell. I was just saying, look, this is bad. And it's going to give. By May of 2008, I wrote my last article saying, it's coming within a few months, we're going to have a major, I mean almost apocalyptic disaster. Of course, that made me look legitimate. Yeah, apocalypse is coming, sure. Well, it happened. But the problem is that we had these rating agencies clear up until the end. They were saying that the corporate bond market is good, it's solid, it's sound. Companies that were actually on the verge of coming apart at the seams and blowing up from the ass to the mouth, these credit agencies like Standard & Poor's were saying, you're okay. I can tell you what I think was going on was they're okay because they were paying their fees, these massive fees on time to these companies. So there you go. Anyone have a question so far about this? Yeah?
So is investment?
There was consumption. There was public. There was private investment, I. C is private consumption. I is private investment. G is government spending. And then you have your net exports. Let me write it down for you. I'll just write it down. I don't want to get too far into economics in this class, but I'll write this part down for you. Look, it went like this. Let me mute the projector here for just a second. Okay. National income is consumption plus investment plus government plus your exports minus your imports. Now, the way an economy, you can put an economy together all kinds of different ways. And this is just one way that we can account for the nation's income production. It comes from consumption, which is the largest part of the income of of our economy. Somewhere between 67% and 70% of our economy's income is driven by consumption. Then there's this private investment component. What is generated in income from the private investment, from the business community? And then there's what is generated from public investment, from government spending, on military, social programs, that whole nine yards. And then there is the income we get from our net exports, our exports minus our imports. Historically, for a long time, this has been a big, fat, negative number. But actually, that's a good thing because, in a way, what that does is that when we export dollars overseas to buy cheap products, those countries like China have to import those dollars back here because that's the only place they can spend the dollars that we send them. So essentially, this big negative on the exports was supporting these three. And it had been getting very serious during the Bush administration. But what happened in about, you could see it happening earlier, that the private investment component, in other words, investment in companies growing and maintaining their, even just maintaining themselves, had been losing ground in the mix to consumption and government. By the time we get to the end of 2007, the 2007 data indicated that not only was it losing ground, it had actually fallen from 2006. By the time the data in the early first quarter of 2008 came in, that trend was confirmed. Private investment was beginning to drop severely, noticeably. It had historically been around 17%. It had buckled down and it was starting to show signs that it was headed for 15%. A 2% off 17%, that's a serious drop in business investment. Government wasn't giving up. We were in the middle of two great wars, killing a lot of people, blowing shit up. Consumption hadn't given up yet. People were still talking about how sorry their lives were, that they couldn't redecorate their master bedrooms and all that kind of stuff. But it was still great for everyone except the poor. And these credit rating agencies just kept giving these big, big, nice AAA ratings to the bonds of corporate America. Credit instruments that were backing or were credit derivative swaps, CDOs, they were getting high credit ratings. Standard & Poor's was one of the worst in this regard, one of the worst. And that's why I have this taint in my mouth at these credit rating agencies. Oh, after it was all over, they found Jesus. Sure. Oh, we saw what we did wrong, and it was just a technical flaw. Don't worry, our credit rating is sound and solid. With great irony, I tell you that early in last year, Standard & Poor's downgraded the credit rating of the United States government debt. They downgraded it. First of all, no, the government is not going to default on its debt. We'll just attack another country and destroy it and liquidate its wealth. We're America. We're not going to, but Standard & Poor's, wanting to show that it was really serious about credit rating, downgraded the debt of the U.S. government, which didn't impress me at all because it showed that they were just doing a PR move. So to this day, I caution you, always do your own analysis. Don't just look at a credit rating agency's rating on a corporate bond. That can give you a guidance. Certainly, a C-grade bond is junk. Everyone knows it. But an A-grade bond, AAA, AA+, depending upon what credit rating agency you're looking at, who knows? I tell you right now, it's a good thing to look at, but don't use that as your entire basis for investment decisions, especially if you're looking for investment-grade bonds. And when I say investment-grade bonds, I'm talking about the bonds that have A ratings, AA, AAA, AA+, depending upon what the system is. Okay, just be careful about it because these credit rating agencies, they have demonstrated, at least to me, that they are not the end-all be-all of knowing what companies are sound and what are not in terms of the guarantee of future expected cash flows, the surety of future expected cash flows. Now, know this. Bonds have priorities. Like, for example, there could be a senior bond. Now, what that means is that it's not in its fourth year of college. Or for some of you, your seventh year of college, whatever. Now, that would be a bond that is old, or it's a bond that will be paid off first. If there's a liquidation of the company, those bondholders get theirs, and then every other bondholder sucks hind teat. From here down, you will get different kinds of bonds, like senior subordinated, junior subordinated. And I mean, it depends on the company, what you're going to see. You can see structures of priority of payment of the bondholders that are all kinds of complicated. It depends upon the company. But you look at the bond, for the most part, as a bond's priority, seniority goes down, its yield will tend to go up. The coupon the company pays will tend to go up, because if there were a catastrophe and the company could not survive, then a junior bond would get money after the money had been paid to the senior bondholders to take care of their position. Now that's one way. And know this. There's a term called a mortgage bond, and it's just like a mortgage that you have on a home. A bond itself is nothing but a promissory document. Attached to a bond can be a specification of assets that the bondholders can claim in the event of liquidation. So if a bond is called a mortgage bond, that means that it is a bond that has an attachment that says, you get these factories, you get this truck fleet to liquidate, you get this or that. Just like when you get a home mortgage, you're not getting a mortgage. You are issuing a promissory document, promising to pay money. Attached to that would be a mortgage document specifying the house as being claimable by the bank if you default on the promissory document. And that's what a mortgage bond is too. Asset-backed bonds tend to be more safer, obviously, so their yields are lower, their coupons are lower, because in the event of a catastrophe the company goes bankrupt, the mortgage bonds, these asset-backed bonds, get theirs in hard assets. They can say, no one else gets that factory, that's ours, we get to sell that and get our money. And if we get more than we're owed, then we share that with the claims below ours. So you can see mortgage bonds, or you can see bonds that are not mortgage bonds, debentures. Another way that you can break up bonds is that there are bonds that are just clean, pure, straight bonds. You get your coupon, and at the end, you get your face value with your last coupon. But then there are these bonds that have some little tricks in them. You negotiate this with the lenders at the time that the corporate bond is issued. One type is a callable bond. Callability in a bond means that the company could, at its discretion, pay off the bond early. A callable bond is a bond that the company could pay off early. Now, usually the callability provision doesn't kick in for a few years, but a company would love this is if prevailing interest rates in the economy drop, then what the company could do is simply call in its high coupon bonds and reissue bonds at a lower coupon rate. It's like refi. It's like if you had the provision that you could refinance a mortgage. So obviously the lenders, seeing this as an adverse clause to their interests, would ask for a higher coupon rate if the company, the borrower company, the issuer of the bond, wanted a callability provision. Callability, it actually is not that uncommon, and companies can call bonds early. But like I said, usually a callability provision doesn't happen right away. You can't say, we can call it anytime after we issue it. No, maybe we could call it 5 years from now. After 5 years, we could call it in if it is in the company's interest to call it in and refinance. Understand that the investors, again, won't like this, because if interest rates have fallen, then what's going to happen is they're going to get their money back, all of it, and they're going to have to reinvest it at a lower interest rate. Another provision that is in a company's interest, that is something that the investors, the lenders, are definitely not going to like, and so this is going to cause a lot higher coupon, is convertibility. A convertible bond is a bond where the company, under certain circumstances, could convert the debt into equity. That would really, really suck. If a company is in so much trouble that it can't pay its interest payments, if it has convertible debt outstanding, it could turn that debt into stock. And then the bondholders are stuck with something that doesn't have to pay a dividend ever, that doesn't ever have to do anything except make them wonder why in the hell they invested in a convertible bond. Convertible bonds are not generally a good idea if you are just looking for good investment certainty. Bonds in general are safe instruments, especially high-grade investment-grade bonds. But convertibility is a dark shadow, because in a convertibility scenario, if the company were in trouble, it couldn't pay its interest payments, instead of going bankrupt and the bondholders can eat the company up, liquidate its assets, or negotiate in a reorg, with convertible bonds, the company just says, okay, you're all stockholders now. Sorry for your luck. That's it. Convertibility is out there. Bonds are issued. The convertible bonds are issued all the time. It's just that if they are issued, the investors, the lenders are going to say, you want this covenant in the bond? That's fine, but you're going to have to pay us a serious amount more in interest if you want this provision in your bond. Okay? So, bonds are a great place for people to invest, especially bond mutual funds. But bonds in and of themselves are really no place for beginners to start, because there are things that can happen. When you look at a ticker on a bond, and I'm not going to tell you everything that you could see in a ticker, but when you look at a bond price ticker, be careful. Little letters beside it tell you things about the bond that might not be something that a non-sophisticated investor would really want to get involved in. I'm going to tell you one more type of bond, but I've got to take you back to the 1990s. As I told you, this was just like a Wild West heyday. It was where I cut my teeth in consulting and all of that kind of stuff. The stock market was roaring. You had this completely unregulated new market in what was called derivatives, credit derivative swaps. There was no regulation of it, and there was a conscious effort to keep regulation off it, because the idea was, this is such a cool thing, we need to foster the development of this market. And the best way to do it is to keep government out of the picture while this market sorts itself out. Now, just to give you an idea of just a quick view of derivatives markets. Essentially, and this is awfully simplistic, derivatives are a way to move risk from those who don't want that risk to those who do want that risk. So, in a sense, think about this. Now, options and futures are primitive derivatives. Think about this. You own a trucking company. You're in the business of hauling stuff from one part of the country to another. That's your business. The problem is that when gasoline goes up in price, that increases your cost and reduces your profit, right? And when gasoline goes down in price, that decreases your cost and increases your profit, right? But you see, you're not in the business of gasoline. You're in the business of distribution. You should not want the risk associated with gas price volatility. If you do, you're stupid. You're a trucker. You're a trucking kind of man. I mean, I've seen you bend over, your pants show your crack. You should not be in the business of bearing price volatility in gasoline markets. That's not your core business model. Yes, we're going to make money when gas prices go down, and we're going to get our ass kicked when gas prices go up. That's what we do. No, it's not what you do. You see it? Wouldn't it be great if there were some way that you could transfer gas price volatility risk to someone who is into gas price volatility risk? Wouldn't that be great? Okay, that's what derivatives markets do. That's what derivatives are all about, is moving risk from those who don't need, want, or desire that risk to those who are in the business of handling that risk. Imagine this. Woman, you found the man of your dreams. Men, you're men, right? Okay, I gotta be sensitive these days. I've been on the internet. Okay, now, this guy is awesome. He makes great money. He cares about you deeply. You go out to dinner, dancing, champagne. But you see, one night a month, and he comes over every night. One night a month, he turns into a werewolf. You know, eat my dog. I don't know what the heck. Concentrate. Wouldn't it be great if you had a friend, you know, this lady is your girlfriend. Hey, listen, I'd like to share my boyfriend. There's this one night a month, it's like, you know, the full moon, when I really have other things to do. So would you like to have my boyfriend over at your place? Just that one night a month. You know, be sure you have a lot of red meat and keep the cats in the basement. You see the point, though, what's going on here. Wouldn't it be nice if you could move risk away from yourself and keep all the good benefits that went along with the asset itself? He's a great asset. He's just got some very, very bad habits, you know, like, you know, hiking up on trees on one night of the month. Understand what I'm saying here. That was the context that it was a wonderful idea. It was wonderful. Credit derivatives. There were other wonderful ideas in this era too. Suppose that you're a company. You've started a company. You know that this company is going to be incredible. The sky is the limit. You're sure of that. But you also know that you're going to need a hellacious amount of capital. Right now, you're going to have to do research and development for 5 years, and then the good times will roll. My name is Michael Milken. I got an idea. Why don't we issue something that I call a ZCB, a zero coupon bond? It doesn't pay anything to the lenders for 5 years, and then you just pay it off. You need $1,000? Well, let's work it out this way. I tell you what. We'll have these investors lend you $575 now, and you pay them back $1,000 in 5 years. That's a zero coupon bond. Just pay off the face value. It's a discount bond. It's a deep discount bond. Now let's work that out. I invest $575 in your company. And what I get is $425 back in 5 years. How do I figure the yield on that? I do plus one and take it to the 1/5 power. That's how we do it, minus one. Work out your yield on that son of a dog. Yeah, I know my battery's low. 425 divided by 575 plus 1, raise that to the 0.2 power, minus 1, times 100%. It's 11.70% bond. That's the yield, the annual yield on it. You good? Yeah. Coupon is what you paid every year on a bond. But a zero coupon bond pays no interest along the way. It just pays you one whack at the end. In this case, the yield is 11.70% on an annualized basis. That's not too bad, except for Michael's game was, you think any investor is going to give you 575 for 1,000 in 5 years? Try this. Tell you what, the best I can do for you is 390. They'll give you 390 today. 5 years from now, you have to pay them $1,000. You said this company is going to go, the sky's the limit. Sure, you can afford $1,000 in 5 years. You get your 390 now. Let's do it again with Michael figuring prices. 1 plus 390. I'm sorry. In this case, the investors, well, let me do it up here. The investors will get a return of $510 on an investment of $390 plus 1 to the 1/5 power minus 1. That's how much, what is it? 610. Geez, I almost screwed myself out of a good day. $610 for a $390 investment, add 1 to it, raise it to the 0.2 power, subtract the 1, times it by 100. These were called junk bonds because in the reality of it, they were never going to pay off the investors. The companies were never going to be able to generate enough borrowed capital with these low prices Milken and his crew were doing. They just couldn't do it. They just didn't, I mean, they issued tons of this zero coupon junk just to get enough money for their dot-com R&D and all that kind of stuff. It just didn't work. By the time we get to near the end of the 90s, all hell was breaking loose. Milken went to prison. Everyone was swearing reform in the capital markets. Never did really occur too much. But at least we were all informed that zero coupon bonds are junk bonds. Gives you an idea, though, there are all kinds of ways to work the world. In the 1990s, so much was going on. Innovative instruments. I mean, at the end of the day, a zero coupon bond was the only way we could work it out so that these startup companies that weren't going to generate money for a number of years could get some money to get themselves started. So in defense of men like Milken, who the hell else was going to have an idea of how to do this? In defense of the credit derivative swaps industry, who the hell else was going to figure out a way to move risk as efficiently as CDOs did? They just went completely crazy because there was nothing to stop them from issuing crap, either in the junk bonds market or in the derivatives market. And there were other markets too. And there are still other markets out there now to this day. You have to be cautious even now because really regulation has not gone anywhere. The efforts to try to crack down to regulate are a joke. They really are. There's nothing keeping the markets from going bananas. Credits, derivatives are being written all the time right now. Even after the disaster, the only thing that slowed them down was that some of the big players went bankrupt. But the players that are surviving are riding them like a boss. Now I've said some things about derivatives, bonds, all that kind of stuff. I want to show you some stuff that's very tangible. Turn this off for a while. I'm going to show you some stuff. Quotes. Again, walk carefully in bond markets, because even though bonds are safe, there are bonds. One thing I should bring up to you. There are bonds that are actually like the typical, you know, your notes, 7, 10, 15, bonds, 20, 30 years. You can actually find bonds out there that have lives of 50 years. There's bonds that have lives that are even longer. Know this, those bonds, a lot of bonds, are highly desirable to companies that don't need money back right away. It would be preferable for an insurance company that issues life insurance policies to have its face value of its investments pay off way in the future, because their payoff load, when they write an insurance policy for you, you'll probably live 50 years. So it would be desirable for them to have instruments where the bulk of the cash flow comes back to them in 50 years, because actuarially that's about when you'll die. Okay, 30 years in your case. But think about this. A property and casualty insurance company that insures events that have very low frequency but extremely high severity. Their desire would be to buy bonds, safe instruments, because they really probably will need the money. They can't risk, but they would want the big payoff part, the face value, to come many, many decades in the future. Like, for example, in this part of the country, you know that there have been catastrophic earthquakes, in even one in recorded history. It was along a fault line, an ancient fault line out here called New Madrid. There was one when early explorers were out in this area. One of those incredibly awful earthquakes happened. It was so bad that the explorers said the Mississippi River turned around and flowed backwards. It actually didn't. What they saw was that the earthquake threw the water so hard that it went back the other way from the delta. It was that severe. Now think about if a New Madrid type of earthquake happened today, with all this being the center of the country, with all the pipelines, oil pipelines, gas pipelines, crisscrossing, coming up from Texas, coming from the coasts. Well, we would essentially be the human equivalent of gristle by the time it was over in this part of the country. But it probably won't happen in your lifetimes. Probably won't happen for another 200, 300, maybe 500 years, but it will happen. So insurance companies that insure earthquakes in this part of the country, they probably wouldn't want to make investments that have that pay off in a very short amount of time. So they'd be interested in a 100-year bond. You, on the other hand, probably would, if you're investing in bonds, you would probably be more interested in those in your middle age, a little older, so that you could get money in a fixed income kind of way over the next 20 to 30 years until you died from the coupons. Let me show you a couple of some bond quotes. Now, I'm going to FINRA here. Most of the other quotation services now just leave it alone. And I'm going to show you a couple of, these are active. These are investment grade. Now, when I say investment grade, I do want you to notice that Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch are all listed. And investment grade, a B, obviously, in a Moody's system is investment grade. And in S&P, BBB plus is investment grade. You notice that you can almost see the differences in the ratings, how they do their ratings. A's and B's and C's, yeah. But some use numbers, some use pluses, some use lowercase letters as opposed to capital letters for different designations. But these are all investment grade. Now, just looking at one, one that's a good investment grade bond. Well, Vail Overseas, there, yeah. I mean, it's decent investment grade. And on a given day, of course, there will be buyers and sellers. If you look at the close was at 101, a little above par. And if you look at its yield, 4.14, that is a little below its coupon, just like we saw in the exercises we did. But this bond fell in price. It fell about $7.90. Now again, notice the quote. That's a tenth of the price. Don't think you're going to spend $101. You'd spend $1,018. Going through some of these, notice these coupon rates. In general, these are investment grades, so the coupons are going to be low. They're also going to be low because these bonds, most of them were issued in relatively recent times when interest rates have been so darn low in the economy. Notice your maturity dates on them. This one is almost due, which means that it is going to be very close to par. Because as a bond gets closer to its maturity date, essentially it doesn't matter the spread between the coupon and the yield. As a matter of fact, the yield is almost irrelevant here. All bonds, whether they are at a premium or a discount to par, they approach par. Just logically, on the day that a bond pays off, it should be worth $1,000 because you're going to get $1,000 later that day. So regardless of where a bond starts its path at a discount or a premium to par, as they approach maturity, they're going to get closer and closer to $1,000 because you're getting closer and closer to the guaranteed date on the paycheck of $1,000. Going down through here, just looking at some of these, notice that some of these are pretty good premiums to par right now, which means that your yields are going to be fairly low compared to the coupons. Matter of fact, this one, at 104.8, that's almost $1,050, its yield is way below its coupon. And you could do these calculations on your calculator. We did this. This is how they get the yields. The prices form in the market, and then the yield is calculated from the price. Just like you do, except they probably do it in an Excel instead of a TI-83+. Now let me go through high yield bonds, most active high yield bonds. That means that these are, shall we say, not investment grade bonds. Lehman Brothers, it's selling at 30. That's $301.25. Why is it selling so ridiculously far away from par that they don't even try to calculate the yield? Why is that? Do you know? Yeah. Yeah, the company is bankrupt. These bonds are, you buy one of these, you're very likely to get zero, nothing off it. Now, some of these are just in trouble, or they are just very, very unlikely to pay off, or there's worries about them. Capital One right now. Price is way at a premium to par. Its coupon is 10.25%, and its close was at 103. Even there, you can't even talk about a yield on something like that. It gets to the point where yield is almost ridiculous to talk. Here's some convertible bonds. Notice how these are, this one is a sucky bond. Look at this thing. What the hell does D mean? I don't even know what D means. Okay, but whatever it means, it's bad. Because notice that the bond, look at its price. It should be an awful lot closer to 100 than to 23. Yeah. It is in default. I don't know PMI group. Maybe, yeah, you're right. Okay, but notice that most of these are not in good territory. Although, notice, convertible doesn't mean it's a junk bond. Look at Medtronix. Medtronix is a very good bond. Low coupon. Yield is almost right on the button. It's selling right on the button at par. Look at that. Its yield at 3 decimal places is identical to its coupon. And so it sells at exactly par. You go through these and you want to keep, just if you're interested in this kind of stuff, you can see that, well, there are different kinds of bonds. They don't have any callable bonds in there. They don't break those out. But now the last thing to talk about here is if you look at the active investment grade bonds, gainers versus losers, what do you see? More gainers or more losers today? Yeah, more losers. So in other words, losers are bonds that which have had the price go down for the day. If the price is going down, what does that mean investors are doing? If the price is going down, what are investors doing? Yeah? They're buying them? They're selling them. They're getting rid of them. They are because they don't want them. They're moving out of the bonds. Okay? Now, that would mean, okay, investors are dumping bonds. On net, it looks like the investors were getting rid of bonds. So let's go over and say, well, that obviously means that they were going to stock. A flight away from quality, maybe. So let's look at equities. Let's look at the overall equities market and see what happened. Okay, that really helped me a lot there. Okay, that sucks. I want the actual Standard & Poor's quote, market data. Okay, the Dow went up 19. That's not spectacular, but it did go up. So the bonds lost ground. I can say right now, okay, bonds lost ground because investors were selling them. Investors were selling them because they were using the money, apparently, to go into stock. This was a flight away from quality. That would be an expression of confidence in the economy. In other words, there is more of an interest in investing in something that's a little riskier, stock, rather than bonds. Okay, so at the same time, though, the stock market went up a measly, lousy 13 points. Now, if you look at that information right there, that's only a 0.15% increase in that stock market. But if I look at all of the other ones, the NASDAQ, the Standard & Poor's, the Russell 2000, Global Dow, Nikkei, FTSE 100, all of these other indices went down. That would tell me, and I'm showing you how to think as an analyst, that would tell me that this was a highly concentrated move to a very specific kind of equity. There was not a massive roaring, let's all run over and get ourselves on board stocks. This was let's get rid of some of our safer assets, but let's not get crazy. Let's just kind of move them into things that are still safe, but on the equity side where we can earn a little bit better return on them. Now, here's a prediction for you. No guarantees on it, but over the next couple of weeks, you're going to hear more talk about a war with Iran. And the time of year, the spring rains are getting to the favorable place. We got a couple of nice full moons when the skies will be favorable. So there's going to be talk about war. That doesn't mean there's going to be a war, but there's going to be talk about it. If the talk gets serious about war and you were thinking ahead of the market, where would you head? Into stocks or into bonds? Or maybe into zombie apocalypse movies and how to deal with it? Where would you go? Or where would you invest trying to get in front of the massive investors? Where would you go? Not that there would be a war. That's not the issue. It is the expectation that matters. Where would you go? What would you invest in? Woman, where would you invest? Good. Why? Yes, the flight to quality. You say that term, people will be so impressed with you. There's a flight to quality I foresee in the near future. You will also see a movement, but does that mean that you should invest in no stocks whatsoever? Should you just abandon stocks, say FTS, fancy that scenario, FTS, and get out of stocks entirely? Or is there a more intelligent move that you could make with stocks? Come on, you're a soldier. What would you do? What do you use as a soldier?
What
do you use to kill people?
A weapon.
Yeah, and we used to use bullets. I don't know if you still use them or not, but they're pretty cool. They make people just dance around and say Jesus. Okay. Like I told you, and I don't know if you heard me, I'm a Jew. Okay, I'll even say Jesus when someone shoots me. Okay? He was a rabbi. Get off it. Okay, now. So in other words, what kinds of stocks would be intelligent to invest in if there's going to be a war and this will not be, oh, we'll just bomb them from the skies and that's how we fight wars these days? No, you guys will be drafted. You'll be going in the sand and all that. What would you invest in?
Probably oil.
Well, that's a little difficult to invest in. You go into futures, you can get your ass kicked. How about investing in military companies? Companies that are heavily involved in military provisions. Building of weapons systems, intelligence operations services, mercenary companies, all of that kind of stuff. You see, the point is that you don't think, oh, well, war, we run to the bonds and we get away from the stocks. No, you run to the bonds, absolutely, just like you said. But you also intelligently stay in the stocks. Look at the composition of what went up in the Dow, and that'll tell you where the investors are moving already. And it might disturb you a little bit if you looked at it carefully. That's all I have for you. Thank you.